My name's Cameron Hager. I'm one of the pastors here as well. Hi. If you're new here, or just as a reminder, if you're not new here, we have been trucking through the gospel according to Matthew now for months, and we have reached chapter 20, verse 1. So if you have a Bible, you could go ahead and turn there. But I want to ask you to do something in relation to this. We're going to cover a parable of Jesus. That's what he's getting into this week. And it's probably one, if you grew up in a church, I'm sure that the language of this parable is probably burned into your brain at some point. And even if you haven't, this has kind of a couple key ideas that are sort of just classic Jesus-isms. But as I've studied this parable, I've kind of realized it's actually got some surprising twists and turns. And so for those of us that don't remember it super clearly, or maybe some of us that have never heard it, I'm going to ask you to not read ahead in this. So we're going to be in chapter 20, verses 1 through 16. If you're like me, when the passage goes up there, the first thing I do is kind of read the whole thing and tune out for the first minute or two and kind of get my bearings and then return to the sermon. And I would just ask, if that is you, please don't do that, you nerd. That'd be awesome. So, yeah, that's totally what I do. But I think we will be surprised by Jesus if we sort of take this story bit by story bit, beat by beat, and let it speak that way rather than sort of reading the whole thing. So, let's do this. I guess the first thing we need is a little bit of context. This chapter 20 comes right after chapter 19. Surprise, surprise. And it's actually one continuous story, starting with the rich young ruler that Josh discussed last week. So if you remember last week's sermon, there's this man. He's rich, he has wealth, he's young, he has youth, and he's a ruler. He has status, he has influence in his community. And he comes to Jesus, and he asks the question, what good thing must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus asks, well, keep the commandments. And he says, I've kept the commandments. And apparently he's sincerely done a pretty good job of keeping the commandments. Jesus doesn't question him on that. But what Jesus does do is say, okay, well then if you want to follow me, if you want to be perfect, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. And the man, it just cuts right to the core of this man. And it says that he walks away saddened. We assume that he was not able to do that. He would not part with his wealth to follow Jesus. So what happens next, in the same breath, Jesus is kind of explaining what happened here. And then it says, verse 27, chapter 19. Then Peter said in reply, see, this is classic Peter, see, we have left everything and followed you. What then will we have? So Peter's watching this exchange, and he sees the rich young ruler, and he sees that this man is unable to do the thing that Jesus asked. And quickly, Peter's wheels start turning. And Peter's like, oh, wait a second, we're doing that. We've actually left behind everything to come follow Jesus. So if this guy is rich and famous and young and cool, oh, how good are things going to be for us if we've actually been obedient to the Lord on this issue? And Jesus has a very patient response. He says, well, yeah. I say to you, in the new world, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, so when the kingdom actually does arrive in its fullness, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So yes, disciples, you will have... There is something in it for following me. Yes, I'm not just calling you to a life of endless sacrifice. There's a point to it. He says, then he adds this, though, in verse 29. And in fact, everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my name's sake will receive a hundredfold, and will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and the last first. So Jesus answers Peter, yes, you'll be rewarded for following me, but it's not just you. In fact, anyone who sacrifices to follow after me will be rewarded. But many who are first will be last, and the last first. He sort of ends with this enigmatic phrase that a lot of us probably associate with Jesus. And then this parable in chapter 20 is actually to explain what that little statement means. In what sense in the kingdom of heaven will the first be last and the last be first? We know it's related because the first word in chapter 20 is for. It's an explanatory conjunction there. And then at the end of this story in verse 16, he repeats this principle. So the last will be first and the first last. So whatever this parable is about, it's explaining what Jesus means by this principle. How status and prominence and value is going to work in his kingdom. So, here we go. Let's read this thing. Chapter 20, verse 1. Take the first little chunk here. Jesus says, for the kingdom of heaven. So we get the first clue here. It's a kingdom parable. Once again, he's telling us how the kingdom operates. It's like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them, he said, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever's right, I will give you. So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. So we'll pause there for a second. So an important piece of background here is that for Jesus' day, to be a day laborer was a very, very vulnerable position. And in fact, it is in our culture as well. When you don't have fixed work, it leaves you very, very dependent on everyone. And these were people who they had no social welfare system to fall back on. And even in this culture, servants and slaves were typically, not necessarily always, but they were typically, usually, in a much better position because slaves, servants, they were given a home. They were given a place to stay. They had a steady contract of work to complete. Typically, the owners treated them well, treated them respectfully, wanted to provide for them, wanted to protect their investment that they had in these workers. And so they wanted to keep their morale high. They wanted to keep them provided for. For day workers, this was not the case. This was not the case at all. In fact, day workers, day laborers, could often be overworked, underpaid, and even abused. And there was little accountability that would come. So we have this group of workers who have gone out to the market. They have no steady work, and they're hoping that today will be the day that someone picks them up and has a job for them and has money for them. And the way the Jewish work day would work is it corresponded roughly to sunrise to sunset, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. So early first thing at sunrise, 6 a.m., the owner goes out and he picks up a group of people. He says, I will give you a denarius a day, which is the standard day's work amount. So he's basically saying, I'm going to give you the typical fair wage for working for me for a day. And they agree. And this isn't a story that Jesus is, this isn't a historical story Jesus is retelling us. It's a parable. It's a story he invented for teaching a lesson. But in the context of the story, I think we can all imagine how excited these workers would have been. Given the uncertainty of that day and whether they were even going to be able to bring anything home to their children and their families, they were probably super excited. Not only were they picked up for work, but they were picked up first. They were going to get the entire day's wage. This is huge. So you can sort of imagine them like looking around and just fist pumping a little bit and getting excited. And they go. They go and they work. So what happens next? Going out about the third hour, the owner sees others in the marketplace. So this is about 9 a.m. He sees them and he says, you go into the vineyard as well, and whatever is right, I will give you. So they're kind of left to assume, okay, so he'll probably pay us for, three quarters of the day of work. That's great. This will be good. He'll give us a fair amount for the hours that are left in the day. So they go. And then he goes out again at the sixth hour, at noon, at the ninth hour, at 3 p.m., and he did the same thing. He made the same offer. I will give you what is fair, what is right. Then, the first twist in the story comes here in verse 6 as we move on. It says, about the 11th hour, the master went out, and he found others standing. He said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one has hired us. So at the 11th hour, this is 5 p.m., there's one workable hour left in the day. These guys are still there in the market, just waiting and hoping. At this point, just hoping for scraps, basically, for what, a 12th of a day's wage that they might be able to scrounge up. We're kind of left to assume, I think safely, that these were the least desirable workers of the bunch. These were the ones that were overlooked by every other landowner or person with work to offer. They were the kids on the playground who were last picked for the team, kind of left sitting there. So I imagine they were excited, and I imagine, you know, and even this act in and of itself is pretty generous on the landowner's part, because I mean, how much work is really going to get done in that last hour? So you can imagine them going, oh, well, this is great. We'll at least have something to return to our families with at the end of the day. And so he picks them, says, you guys go into the vineyard too. Okay, so he's hired this bunch for 1 hour. What's going on? We're about to find out. Next verse. When evening came, so maybe just an hour later, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, he said, call the laborers, pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. So, whoa. The guys who were the least able, who worked the cool afternoon hour, who worked 1 hour out of 12, were given the entire day's wage. I mean, just imagine for a second how ecstatic they were to get a whole day's wage for 1 hour. This is incredible. They were going to be heroes when they returned home after this. It's incredible generosity on the landowner's part. So naturally what happens? And here we go. Verse 10. Now when verse 10. When those hired first came, they thought they would receive more. And why wouldn't they? You can just imagine them kind of sitting there and seeing the last hired get paid, and they see a denarius. Oh, these guys get a denarius for this? And you can see them sort of elbowing each other. Oh, this is going to be so good. What are we going to get? 12 days wage, maybe? 2 days? That would be great in and of itself. And they get excited. They start to dream a little bit. But what actually happens? Each of them also received a denarius. Okay. So at this point, they have a couple of options. They could respond with excitement for the marginalized people who had come late to the workday. They could go, wow, these guys really aren't that able. This is incredible that they're going to get a whole day's wage. They probably won't be hired tomorrow. This is incredible for them. What a good and generous master. You think that's where this is going? No. No, they're humans. They're humans. And so that is not where this story is going. They actually go another direction. And we can look at the next verse, 11. On receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house. These same men who we imagine were so excited at the beginning of the day to be given work by what appeared to be a faithful and trustworthy landowner. They were going to get to work a whole day. It was going to be great. It was totally unexpected, unguaranteed that they would get this. And he kept every promise he made to them. He gave them their full day's wage. But they grumbled. And they said, these last worked only 1 hour. And you've made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. And they kind of have a point, right? I mean, a little bit. It's true. These guys have worked the whole day. They had the high noon sun on their backs. They worked a 12-hour intensive day at the vineyard. And this other group worked 1 hour in the cool of the afternoon, and they were paid the same. They're paid the same. So while they have a legitimate point, they try to raise a justice issue here, it seems. They're claiming, it seems implicitly, that some sort of wrongdoing has happened, right? You have not been fair to us. Now, is that true? Is that true? I'd say no. I'd say no. Once again, the owner, he kept every promise that was made. And it was generous to offer this work to them in the first place. So what's going on here? What's going on here? I would say there's no justice issue at hand here. Justice has been kept. And while we don't know the motivation of the master, we don't know why he chose to give more to the others, the offense has only come to these early workers when they stopped focusing on the good that had been done to them, and they started looking side to side in comparison to the ones who had been given what they think of as more generously, more generously. I think the key issue of this passage is right there on that phrase. You have made them equal to us. That's what they're upset about. That's what they're upset about. And frankly, they can try to disguise it in language of fairness or justice, but this is pure, unadulterated envy rooted in comparison, rooted in pride, I would argue. There's something about communicating the scriptures, whether it's here on a Sunday morning, whether it's in the context of a community group, whether it's over a cup of coffee with a friend. There's something about it that should and does instill a little bit of fear and trembling, because inevitably when we're trying to reflect and teach and be faithful to the words of Jesus, we inevitably fail to measure up. And so as Jesus puts his thumb down on this issue of comparison and envy and pride, I particularly feel that burden because, just to be honest with all of you, this is one of the primary issues of sin in my life. And even over the last couple weeks as I've been preparing this, I've been just feeling extremely unfit to stand before you all and talk about not being comparative, not being prideful, because this is my thing. This is my thing. One of my things, at least. I mean, and I don't want to speak for all of you, but I imagine there are probably a lot of us in this room who have felt this little twinge in our heart whenever you see someone who's close to you, or maybe they're not that close to you, when something goes well for them. Sure, you can celebrate and be happy and put on a smile, but for me, oftentimes, not every time, oftentimes, there is something else lurking inside of here, and that's some sort of anger, bitterness, jealousy, hatred. You've probably experienced this at work. Regardless of where you work, there are times when your coworkers, your friends, or your enemies, we never use the word enemy enough, it's such a good word. That person is my enemy. When someone at work gets a promotion a promotion. There's something in there that just in that moment starts to grate on you. And yes, you can sort of do your little golf clap and half smile and celebrate with them. But for me, there's always been something where I instantly begin to compare. Oh, this boss has no idea what this person is like when they're not around. I see how lazy they are. Promotions at work. We feel like we've been slighted in some way when someone else receives something good. Oftentimes. We have a community here at Door of Hope, just as another example. We have a lot of artists in this community. We have a lot of people who are working hard and struggling well to create good and meaningful art, to disseminate it out into the world for various purposes. And occasionally, there are people in this body who find success. It might be commercial success, critical success, whatever that looks like, however you want to define it. And instead, often, of being excited for those people, although we can feign that, there's something else going on inside. I can't... They got recognized for that? They've clearly never heard my stuff. Clearly never seen my work. You guys know what I'm talking about? You've experienced this? I remember specifically in college, I was in a band, and we were trying to take it semi-seriously, and I played drums for the band, and I wrote some of the songs, and we were, you know, playing around town, and very small operation. But there was a guy, one of our buddies, good buddy of the of us in the band, who had his own band, and one year he won the U.S. national like John Lennon songwriting contest or something, something really cool. And I remember, I look back on this with so much embarrassment. I remember throwing this fake tantrum in my dorm room for two. There were two witnesses to this. And I had a notebook, and I was ripping pages out and throwing them and going, ah, and like pretending to tear my clothes. And I was doing a bit, you know, I was goofing around. But I can look back on that moment with crystal clarity and go, that was the real reaction. And I was masking it under this pretense of, I don't know, over-exaggeration. But I was just, I hated that this guy got this acclaim. I hated it. That should have been me. They've clearly never heard my songs. The John Lennon songwriting competition. If only they had heard my songs, their worlds would have been changed. Remember this, doing this on stupid things that don't matter at all. I remember being in junior high basketball, knowing, look at me, do I look like a great basketball player? I remember being in junior high basketball, and my best friend was the star of the team, and he was nominated for all conference whatever, and I remember sitting here smiling, thinking, but my free throw percentage is higher. So stupid. Even relatively recently, and I'm giving you the safe examples, believe me, there are the real nasty ones are in here that only probably a couple people know about. But even the last few years, even the last 6 months, as my wife and I have been considering trying to move out of our, you know, one-bedroom apartment and try to buy a home, and Portland housing market is just insane, as we all know, I remember, like, some of you in this room that are my very, very best friends saying, oh, we found a house, we're going to move in. And like, this half-hearted, yes, I'm happy for them on a certain level. Of course I am. But really, inside, it's, I deserve that. You don't deserve that. And now there's one less house out there that could be mine. What is this thing that's going on in our hearts? What is this? What is it about comparison that instantly drives us to this two-faced, really, hatred for our brothers and sisters? Now, I don't know what to trace it back to. As I thought about it, there's two possibilities. One is just the idea of scarcity. Think about Portland housing. Yeah, I think there's something to that, this idea that there's just not enough to go around. So if somebody gets the promotion, there's only so much budget at our company. Or if someone gets the affection of this person, of my friend, or whoever, they only have so much capacity for intimacy and for friendship, and so that means I'm not getting that portion of it if they are. I think so there's scarcity on one side. I think the other side could possibly just be the pride piece. We think our value, our intrinsic worth, or our identity is being tarnished when we're not getting the recognition we feel we deserve. When you see someone else get it, there's this little jab to your self-worth and value, maybe. You know, Paul in Romans 12:15 tells us that we are to rejoice with those who rejoice, to weep with those who weep. And we often do the opposite. We rejoice in the interior when people weep, when things don't go well. And we weep in here when people are rejoicing because they got something we wanted. And it's to our shame. It's to our shame. So I think this is the issue that Jesus is just pulling the microscope over and looking at. And it really, doesn't it make sense when you step back and think of chapters 19 and 20 in context? Jesus tells this story in light of Peter seeing the rich young ruler, seeing what he has, and Peter quickly turns around and says, well, what's in it for us? What are we going to get? So back to the story. What does the owner do? How does he respond to how they feel? Verse 13. He replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity?" And that, this is the ESV we're reading, that last sentence there, a little more literal, rigid translation from the Greek would be, or is your eye evil because I am good? Remember Tim talking about the evil eye. This is a Jewish idiom that Jesus keeps referring back to. To have an evil eye is to have envy or stinginess or jealousy, clinging on, desperately holding on to the things that you have at the expense of others. Or are you envious because I am good, is what Jesus is saying. The owner calls it like it is. He has done the original group of workers no wrong. In fact, he's given them a job that was not guaranteed to them for a wage that they did not have any right to necessarily. And yet this response. And he grounds it in two realities. The first thing he says is, look, it's my money. Don't I have the right to do what I want to do? So the first is an issue of like his sovereignty and his ability to actually operate things the way he wants. And the second is this. What he wants to do is to go above and beyond in generosity to the person most needing it. That's what he wants to do. I have the right to do what I want with my stuff, and what I want to do is to be really, really generous. Why do you hate that? Why do you hate that? So then verse 16, we get the summarizing principle once again. So this is the way in which the last will be first and the first will be last. Reward in the kingdom of heaven, Jesus' kingdom, it is not according to our own value systems. It will continually surprise us as we've been learning through Matthew. It's an upside down kingdom, as we've been saying, and there will be surprises, and we had best try to cultivate hearts that sincerely love those around us, and where we sincerely want the best for others. It's a truly tragic image to consider in the last day being angry that God has just poured out his grace and blessings on people whom we think are undeserving. Wouldn't that be tragic? And that sort of heart is cultivated now and here. So this parable is a little complex. As I studied it, there are a handful of different ways scholars interpret it as far as what the primary point is. Some think it's about time, you know, who, at what point people come to relationship with Jesus and equal reward, and that's certainly possible. I think that there's something there, but I think Jesus, the way he highlights the reactions and the interpersonal dynamics, I think this is really about the value of the kingdom and the way it upsets the inclinations of our sinful hearts. This quote, you've probably heard it, it's attributed to Teddy Roosevelt. He said, "Comparison is the thief of joy." I feel like we see that right there. I feel like Jesus would agree with that statement. I think taking away from this, like, Jesus would have us strike down every prideful impulse to begrudge the fortune of anyone else. And I think surely, surely part of what Jesus is saying is that we who expect to have earned greatly from God, we're going to be disappointed when we see God's inclusive generosity. You know, there's something to this idea of first becoming last and last being first that even I feel caution about even standing up here before you, because as someone who loves to listen to sermons and has respect for preachers and all of that, I, you know, have this tendency to want to lift them. Oh, they're so holy, they're so good. And I just tell you now, it's crap. It's crap. We will be surprised. We will be surprised at the people who are given prominence in the kingdom. We will be. We will be. And the best we can do now is to just try to cultivate these sorts of hearts like Jesus that are excited for this surprising generosity and that want to serve rather than be served the way Jesus did. You know, it's one thing for Jesus just to tell us not to have these kinds of hearts. It's one thing to say, hey, don't do this. This is a bad attitude to have. This is a bad way to treat people or think about people. But it's another thing for him to actually provide a worldview in which this actually makes sense. You know, if just to look at something popular, it's believed by many, something like materialism, that all that exists is matter in motion. If that's the case, then I don't think you can really do anything with the scarcity problem. There is only so much on this planet. There's only so much in this universe. There's no moral imperative to do one thing or another with it. So grab all you can. Grab all you can. You've got one shot. And then it'll all be forgotten anyway. So grab all you can. In that kind of universe, even human affection, it's limited. People are alive for X number of days, and they're gone. And hopefully you grabbed enough of that affection and intimacy for yourself. Or else someone else is going to get it. That's not the gospel. Jesus actually brings not just an ethical teaching, but he brings an entire worldview and a promise that there is a God who does exist, who is loving, and whose desire to graciously pour out generously on all people can never be exceeded or exhausted. There's a God whose limitless riches will never end, and so there's no scarcity problem. He can give abundantly to each and every person. He desires to. And the gospel reminds us of our pride issue as well, that what we claim we believe is that every one of us has fallen short of the glory of God, and our salvation, our right standing with him, is wholly dependent on his act of grace toward us. We say we believe that, those of us in here who identify as Christians. Why do our hearts betray that? The gospel says, no, you have no basis for pride. You have absolutely no rationale for looking at another and saying, I deserve more, because you are all equally bankrupt before the Father. And yet, if we step back into the story, Jesus is the one who is the good worker, Jesus is the one who left the right hand of the Father, who entered into this brokenness, who took on human flesh and weakness, lived an entire life, and was ultimately put to death and raised from the dead. That the reward that he's always had that is owed to him might be handed to you and to me. He's the opposite of the early workers. He's the one who has laid down every single thing that we might benefit from it, foregoing his own rights, that we might pick them up. Jesus destroys our motivation for comparison, because there's no one to we are to compare ourselves to except for him alone. And the beautiful, one of the beautiful paradoxes of Christianity is that when we compare ourselves to Jesus, we utterly fail, and yet he extends grace and says, I love you. Here's my righteousness. I think this parable is about the kingdom. I think this parable is about the way that the value system of the kingdom does not comport with the systems and the hierarchies that we develop, and that we are going to be surprised when the last day comes just how generous this good God is. And hopefully we've understood his character enough and his call enough that that will not be upsetting to us, but that we will rejoice with every measure of goodness that he shows to our brothers and sisters. Amen? So in light of the promises of Jesus, and if what he says is true, then we can afford to be generous. We're not playing the scarcity game where we're having to hang on to everything for dear life. We can be generous with our time. Just practically, I know here at Door of Hope, the children's ministry and the transition to Northeast and Southeast, there's a major need for people who love kids and who love Jesus and who are willing to come and give of their time to serve there. The city of Portland broadly is full of tangible, physical needs that we can rise up as a community to meet and as individuals. If the gospel is true, then we can afford to celebrate with our friends when they get things that we want. Because we know this is not a zero-sum game. But we have a loving Lord who is graciously providing for all of us. So let's fight comparison. Let's fight envy. Let's fight jealousy. Not just because it's a moral teaching, but because we have a Jesus who has proven we don't need these things. He's taken care of it all, and he will. His kingdom is going to be a good kingdom. It's good news for us and for the world. I think we should pray and close.